Hello, everyone. It's rather a coup this afternoon to have got both the director and the writer, Adele Thomas and Rory Malarkey from the Oresteia, the very successful, I thought, and so did most of the critics, Oresteia at the Globe recently. If you read the critics, they will tell you that there having been no Oresteias, no significant Oresteias in Britain since Katie Mitchell put on the Ted Hughes one in 1999 to 2000, that suddenly three have come along. Actually, that's not true. Two have come along. One of them is at present on in Manchester, directed by Blanche McIntyre, a reduced version of the Ted Hughes translation. And the other one was the one at the Globe. The third Oresteia, although it's mentioned Aeschylus on the cover, was a new play, and in many ways a very fine new play, by Robert Icke, but was not an Aeschylus Oresteia at all. It was a play inspired by, with references to Aeschylus's Oresteia. So there have been two Oresteias. The Blanche McIntyre has been, I'd love to get up there, but and I hope some of you will get up there and tell us about it. And the other one was directed by Adele to a script adapted by Rory Malarkey from the original by Aeschylus. So, and I think, you know, from the original was a very good phrase to put on the cover. So I think, I'm hoping they're willing really to respond to any points of interest that anyone wants to raise about that production. But I think it's a good idea if we start with Adele telling us something about how she set about it and what were her priorities, and she has brought some pictures so that any of you who didn't see it will get some idea visually and atmospherically. And then Rory will then talk about how he set about producing the script for it and how it was from the original by Aeschylus, and will give us a couple of passages to show the kind of language and the kind of priorities within his language that he set about in the translation. So we'll start with a just brief set pieces, first from Adele and then from Rory, to remind you, if you saw it, as I imagine a lot of you did, and to put you in the picture if you didn't. So, Adele, over to you, having thanked you very much. I think, actually, with both of them coming distances to see us, we should actually start with some applause, if you don't mind.
Hello. I'm guessing you guys know the story, so I don't have to do any of that stuff. So I thought I'd just bring a couple of pictures. It's a bit scattershot, and I'm sorry, but I just thought I'd kind of bring you some images that kind of charted my kind of creative journey, I guess, through taking on this show. Starting with, I should probably say, we just had a fantastic lunch, and we're just talking about trying out some of the other adaptations in the Globe, because of course the first picture I've got up on the screen is of Shakespeare's Globe itself. And as a theatre space, it has its own unique challenges, and you get a lot for free with that space you don't get in other theatres. And one of those things is, of course, when you're staging an adaptation of a trilogy of Greek tragedies, that the space is probably the most similar we have to the ancient amphitheatres in London. Unless someone's going to tell me that there is an amphitheatre in London, then I'll be completely wrong. That would be most like it. But this certainly is a kind of performance space, as a civic space, as a space that embraces all manner of classes of audience, then the Globe feels to me to be the most similar, certainly public, and obviously the very obvious similarities of it being outdoors and non-mic'd, and you have a natural acoustic, you have the elements with you all the time in performance, that in and of itself is kind of a unique experience making this production. But one of the things we were just discussing was that we tried, when Dominic Dromgoole, who's the artistic director, asked me to take this on, we looked at what adaptations might already exist. that would work beautifully at the Globe. And actually, we didn't find anything really kind of work there. As brilliant as they were, the Ted Hughes adaptation and the Tony Harrison version just somehow didn't sit in this open-air space in the way that we'd kind of imagined. So brilliantly, Dominic and I then started having a conversation about who would adapt it. And I'm really delighted that I managed to bully Dominic into reading Rory's pieces, Rory's earlier plays, and Dominic immediately fell in love with them, as I had done, because I thought Rory was easily the best person around to take on this challenge, not only because reading his biography and not knowing him at all before we started doing this, it was obvious that his learning is kind of, well, obviously goes back to this kind of work, but there's something about Rory's writing which is brilliantly contemporary, but also, I don't know, taps into something far more primal, and I urge you to read his original plays as I sit next to him, don't even look at him, because there is something kind of mythic and primal and essential about his work, which I thought was really exciting in this context. And Rory will do all the brilliant talking about the adaptation. I'm just going to show you pictures and talk about images. So obviously this is the first challenge you have when you seek to do the Oresteia at the Globe. How do you do it in this space? We started, me and the designer Hannah, once Rory had taken on the adaptation, we started to kind of look at what we should do with the world of Argos. And it's obvious this is a very contemporary picture of Greece, as you'll probably guess. But what's going on at the moment was at the forefront of our minds, and that kind of chimed, I guess, to some degree, the kind of feeling of the world being slightly shut down or in flux, or somehow that the office hours are now kind of closed for a bit. Feels like a kind of felt like something that wasn't just happening in Greece at the moment, but felt like it's a very universal kind of way to be living, that certainly where I'm from, the high streets are shutting down kind of fairly regularly, and the world feels slightly desolate. And certainly the world of Argos in the Oresteia feels like where all your men have been gone for 10 years, what does that leave you with? What world do you have? So we started to look at these kind of contemporary images, and this is the first of many, many film stills I will show you. Cinema has easily been cinema's easily my biggest love and ever anyway, but influence-wise, there's a lot of cinema that influenced me, so I'll try and name check as many of them as possible. And so Derek Jarman's films and The World Around Us, the idea of the world as being completely boarded up became the thing that really interested me and Hannah. And this didn't just have a thematic resonance. It also had a practical... There was a practical solution to a problem that we had, which, of course, is that... You can't see this on this because it's actually boarded up itself. But the back of the Globe stage and the Globe stage itself is so colourful that that images like the bloody carpet, the red carpet, the tapestry that Clytemnestra rolls out for Agamemnon when he arrives, they just simply don't resonate on the Globe stage. There's too much colour for that brilliant image that obviously back in the day would have pinged out against the stone or amongst the kind of the monochrome of the amphitheatre, just didn't have the resonance. So we decided to board up the space for that very reason. The first thing, because Aeschylus is the man of the chorus, as me and Rory talked a lot about him, which is what makes his work so exciting and so... obviously, you know better than I do, the kind of brilliant poetic work that's written in... I'm babbling now because I'm just nervous. But the incredible poetry that the chorus have. But I was watching a lot of Greek cinema and ended up re-watching The Travelling Players by Theo Angelopoulos, which I'm sure many of you have seen, which of course is an adaptation of the Oresteia in itself, something I'd completely forgotten until I got halfway through. And I loved their... this kind of refugee community of travelling actors, these people who were kind of forced to leave their homes, who were forever in flux, but there's a kind of nobility and a strange... There's an ability to their impotence, I guess, that I quite liked. They're wearing all of their clothes. They're carrying all of their belongings. They're kind of constantly on the move. And the chorus, this kind of impotent, apolitical chorus of the Oresteia kind of felt like it fitted this kind of aesthetic, I guess. I am denied about whether or not there should be a band of travelling players, but actually we kind of settled on a group of bureaucrats whose faded power or who are whose kind of previous civic authority has been kind of diminished. So that's where that came from. And I really, if anyone hasn't seen this film, I really recommend it. It's fantastic. It's punishing, but it's fantastic. And into that world, we wanted to, one of the things that me and Hannah and Rory, and one of the things that really interested me about doing the Oresteia at all was that while the globe had built it as a radical reimagining, actually I was never really interested in it being that radical reimagining. I think the ancientness of it, the mythicness of it, the ritualistic nature of the piece was what really interested me, especially given that we were going to perform it at the globe. And so we started looking at this kind of wave of fashion. I think this is an Yves Saint Laurent design from the 60s, kind of combining ancient shapes and geometric patterning that feels very ancient and somehow very contemporary, very modernist. And this is one of Hannah's original designs for the costume of Clytemnestra. We can see the kind of fabric pattern ideas around the side. And so we started to kind of design our own, I guess, mythic world of geometric patterns. And that also came from this image, which was an image that I found that reminded me of the music that Mira Kalix, our composer, wrote the music for the piece. And I say music, actually what she did is she created a kind of sonic landscape for the piece, because Mira's music is a combination of live instrumentation and electronica. It's the first time ever in the globe that this has happened, but we managed to convince Dominic to allow us to give the chorus speakers in their costumes that were so that they could kind of mix or live mix the sound themselves as they move through the space. And I guess we wanted to kind of do this because we had very short rehearsal time and I probably would have loved the chorus in another age. I would have loved the chorus to maybe have made some of this sound themselves, but it was a kind of a way for us to replicate the vocal noises, I guess, that the chorus, the ancient Greek chorus, would have undertaken themselves. The texture of the voice, of humming, of chanting. The other thing that Mira kind of limited her palette to were wind instruments. We had bass clarinet and clarinet and saxophones, because she wanted to, the flutes, I know there's a proper word for it that I've completely forgotten. Exactly, absolutely. To kind of be the modern equivalent, I guess. The Into the World, this is obviously a very kind of mid-20th century world that we were referencing, but the one thing that me and Hannah, the designer, became kind of stuck on initially were, who were the soldiers? Who are these returning warriors? It didn't feel apt. Nothing that we kind of went through initially felt like it fitted. So politicians didn't feel right, as you'll probably be aware. They're not fundamental, you know, they're not simply political figures. And similarly, pure soldiers or contemporary soldiers didn't feel right, because then they lacked, I guess, the kind of political ramifications of these ancient figures. So eventually we decided, well, actually the only thing that these men are is they are only ancient warriors. Because, and especially conversations I had with Lucy Jackson, and I think Emanuela, actually you were involved in this conversation as well, there's a fascinating overlap, or something I certainly didn't realise, between the political, the acquisitional, the kind of chief executive function, the world-storming kind of capitalism that kind of came with what these men are or were, and the warrior-ness of them that really only exists in this form, or at least I'll happily take suggestions afterwards if anyone's got any other ideas. So we kind of kept them. This is another one of the designs. We decided that the warriors would be ancient warriors and that they would have returned after what would feel like thousands of years, not just 10, because to us that this must be what it feels like to be a returning soldier. And they were caked in blood from head to toe, so that their conquests, and I guess for Agamemnon, his not just his conquest, but obviously Iphigenia's blood is still very present on his body as he arrived back. We thought this felt very much like what it must feel to be like a soldier. You must feel like you've been gone for millennia, not just for years or days or months or weeks or decades. And also it was a way of us addressing one of the things that was really obvious from the first readings that I did of the Oresteia on my own before Rory came on board, which is, of course, that there's such a strange temporal thing happening in the play, where the plays exist in kind of contemporary Athens to Aeschylus, and they exist in the Trojan War. So we love the idea of kind of playing with time, just, and, you know, Rory, I'm sure, will talk about it in much more detail than me about the kind of anachronisms that Aeschylus employs in talking about a period of history that was so much before his own. So these warriors were then kind of put in counterpoint to the more contemporary riot police, who were Aegisthus's troops, who'd stayed at home. And our Furies were very horror film. We were fascinated by them as kind of little girls and old women and just womanness. So we wanted, some of them were going to be played by men. That was a kind of necessity because the company of actors were shared with another play. So I had no choice. I either had a choice of having maybe three Furies or no men, or to kind of put some men into that chorus as well. But we quite liked their kind of this strange genderlessness of them, that their gender and their age and their femininity was kind of in flux, as was their kind of their preternaturalness, I guess. And so our Athena reference, always for one for a bit of kitsch, but we loved her as a kind of source of light in this kind of very dark world. Even though it was performed outdoors and often in sunlight when we had a matinee, the world itself is so dark that we loved the idea that she could come out like a ray of sunshine. I'm going to try and get through these really quickly. And then the other film that was a huge influence on me was Holy Mountain by Hodorowsky, which again is another film I really recommend. It's a complete mishmash of kind of Hodorowsky's own mythical, he's such an incredible mythic in his own right, and kind of Catholicism, but there's this kind of repeated patterning struck us as being something aesthetically that really interested me, and certainly his way with ritual and his symmetry was really interesting in terms of what we wanted to do with the Eumenides. And I thought I'd show you some pictures of the show. So this is Clytemnestra. You can see I'm boarded up. Unfortunately, it's always really difficult in the Globe to get a wide shot of the stage because in dress rehearsals, there's never any audience in. So it always looks strangely empty. But this is the arrival of Clytemnestra, played by Katie Stephens, who's a fantastic actress and was about as Baltic and visceral as you can possibly imagine, in her kind of new mythic gown with her two attendants. And our Agamemnon and the bloody soldiers. Actually, this is a really stupid question. I saw there was maybe about 3 weeks ago, if the show was still on, I was re-rehearsing another show at the Globe, and I came down the steps and saw, that kind of leads you to the outside of the Globe Theatre, and I saw one of these soldiers having a chat with about 50 tiny school children. And it was just the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen. They're all kind of going, "Why are you all covered in blood, sir?" And he was like standing there, kind of looming over them, absolutely drenched in blood from head to toe. And this is Clytemnestra, kind of post Agamemnon slaying, raising her hand, her weapon of revenge. And this is Aegisthus standing in front of the Echeclema. The kind of what's the word I'm looking for? The kind of conventions of original Greek theatre practice really fascinated me, and it was fantastic, really fantastic to have the opportunity to explore what the power is of something like an echeclema, you know, which might feel to a contemporary theatre maker as a kind of clunky old idea, but actually it was great fun to put that on stage. And that it worked so well, I was very impressed. It's one of those things that go terribly wrong and get you stuck in tech rehearsal for weeks on end. And Orestes and Electra standing over the open grave of Agamemnon, with the chorus, the Libation Bearers chorus, who've got their kind of bloody lashed faces as they engage in the komos, which we wanted to keep, as Rory will again probably explain. The Libation Bearers chorus, I kind of wanted to have some masking in it, although because the Globe stage being what it would have been impossible to have them in masks all the way through. You simply wouldn't have heard a word that they said. But I did want to have at least one moment where we could pay homage to the mask. So in the moment where the chorus of Libation Bearers meet Calissa, I love the idea that this is the only kind of only passage in Greek tragedy, or at least what I've read, I'm happy to be contradicted, where the chorus actively kind of derail the action that's happening on stage, or they actively take part in making action happen, I guess. I thought that would be a lovely time for them to kind of don a mask and then at least kind of take, I don't know, to engage in their own performativity. Here's Orestes and Clytemnestra. I was going to tell an anecdote about... No, I won't. That's for the cup of tea afterwards, just to Louis to have a cup of tea with us. And Orestes, again, outside the Echeclema. The Echeclema being deliberately exactly the same as the one that was at the end of Agamemnon. Although I know that some audience members, I stood next to someone once who said, but that's exactly the same as the other one. That's the point. And here's Clytemnestra as the ghost coming up from the trap. Covered in blood. Poor Katie had to have two showers in the course of this show every single day. And the Golden Phallus, which was the kind of one of the traditions of the Globe theatre, is that at the end of every show they have a jig. And so we naturally have the kind of the Athenian song they sing at the end of the Oresteia, but I quite love the idea of bringing the Dionysian festival to the end of the play. And we had a kind of what me and Hannah imagined as a satyr, a kind of romping around as well, just to kind of give Proteus its kind of at least a little wave to, or nod to Proteus. So that basically is our kind of very, very, very lightning quick creative journey. And shall I leave the cock up, or shall I? Why not? We shall try and do a presentation with a golden penis above us. That's it.
Brilliantly evocative. Okay, so I was about to make some terrible pun about cock-up, but I think Rory, can you introduce us to your role?
I can. Oh, wow. Oh, suddenly wow. I'm, I don't know, on stage. yes, I was employed to do this in January this year, and so it seemed like a very big task to do with 6 months in front of me, and so I thought in that time the best thing for me to do would be just to run at it and to take the text, take the Greek, and to give it my best go all the way through. And so I decided, I suppose there were, of course, initial parameters that we talked about mm-hmm. before even the show. Like, we didn't want, if you were to perform the whole thing, I guess it's sort of in the region of 4,000 lines, maybe a bit more. That would last far too long for an evening at the theatre. So we wanted it to be an evening at the theatre, so sort of 3 hours, give or take. And so that meant, in effect, cutting it down by half. So that was the first thing, the first consideration that I needed to take into account. The second one was just, I mean, you saw at the beginning the space and how it looks. In order to leave the cock and go back to the... it's huge. I think it's the biggest, in terms of capacity, it's the biggest sort of traditional theatre space in the country. There's only there are kind of opera houses and places where they do sort of dance and opera and ballet that are bigger, but in terms of spaces that do plays, this is the biggest one in the UK. And so in order, and because it's unmiked, and because it's up as well as out, it requires a kind of muscularity in the language and a kind of performance that is very different to what maybe one would expect in a conventional play, particularly written in the last, say, 100 years. Mm-hmm. And when you start looking, say, at the plays of Shakespeare, you see that they're custom engineered for that space. And so the way that thought moves entirely through language, but also the way that language is always directed, and always a character, an actor trying to do something, but expressing the kind of the visceral emotion of what that entails. And so I thought it would have to be both huge in terms of its sort of linguistic scope. It would have to employ some musical, relatively conventional musical rhythms. I think for me that's probably why someone like Ted Hughes might not work in the space, because it's often about subverting a kind of conventional rhythm. It needed something of a muscular sort of, you know, drum-like rhythm to get it through, to get it out into the air. And also just to be so that an actor can always know that they're in the space doing something. They're not sort of in the space. There's not a kind of intention in for an actor. You can't really say, oh, at this point you're talking some poetry. Like, they have to be doing something, even if they're the chorus and they're telling a story. It needs to be a kind of clearly intentioned story. I mean, I actually found out, weirdly, I had to go and do... one of the actors was off for a couple of performances in preview, so I had to go and do it on the stage myself. And it was only then, that, I mean, that was the baptism of fire. So I was sitting there with this, quite weird, at the front in sort of black clothes, just sitting on the stage and doing it. And suddenly in that space, I was a chorus member. You realise just how hard you have to work to tell the story, just how technical everything has to be. In a sort of proscenium arch theatre or a theatre with a lighting rig or whatever, you can kind of hope that your intention can be cast out into the darkness and that someone is on the other side of the darkness to catch it. But with this, you have to pick out an individual audience member, send them a thought, and then choose somebody else and send them a thought. And that's how you make yourself heard across that huge space, which was fascinating and terrifying. And it was genuinely the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. But it was a fantastic education in just what it takes to tell the story in that place. I kind of wish I'd done that before I wrote it. But anyway, so with all those technical things aside, I decided that all I really had... I mean, there's obviously a wealth of brilliant critical literature written about the Aristeia, some of it by people in this room. Mm. I decided I wasn't going to read any of that. I was just going to keep my nose as close to the text of the Greek as I possibly could. I studied ancient Greek for a little bit at school when I was quite young, but then I studied Latin all the way through school and at university. And I've translated plays before from Russian, so I sort of knew how translation for the theatre works. It's very complicated and strange and very different actually from writing, but also a lot of the skills are the same. But anyway, that's a completely different discussion. But I knew something a bit about that, but I didn't know it well enough, I think, to be able to kind of say, okay, kind of open the text and, you know, just go, like, have the text and on my laptop and just write that. I was nowhere near that. I mean, Aeschylus is difficult anyway. So I thought it would be good for me to sit down with somebody. So Adele, in fact, saw Dr. Lucy Jackson, who's here, talking about theatre and thought she was approachable and thought she was somebody who would be a good...
Theatre-friendly,
somebody who would be able to kind of take me through and, you know, give me basically, you know, anything between kind of complete idiot's guide, which I would be at certain points, to a relative level of knowledge, which I would be at other points. So, and she was brilliant for that. So we met up a lot and went through every single line. And then once that was done, I could kind of get an idea going through with Adele and talking about it dramaturgically and going through with Lucy and talking about it literarily. From that, I could get an idea of what exactly it was that would need to be cut in order to get it to the right running length, and what exactly it was that was completely crucial and important to keep. So after having done that, I had a pretty good idea of what I would do. I generally actually ended up being, as I think is probably natural in a kind of contemporary format, it ended up being the chorus that was the thing that was compressed. But I really tried my hardest because I didn't want to approach this as a kind of, oh, we don't get the chorus, that's not something we do normally, so like, yeah, just snip that. Didn't want to do that. I wanted to try and find a way of conveying a sense of what they were doing in the text. And so although a lot of the choral loads are significantly compressed, I've tried to keep a flavour of the rhythm of the repeated passages of sort of, so it definitely doesn't feel like something that was definitely doesn't feel like something you'd find in, you know, contemporary realistic drama or whatever. So I sort of thought about meter a bit, and I opted for a kind of iambic meter for the sort of the character passages or the bits of interaction, because I think the initial urge for the globe was iambic pentameter for obvious Shakespearean reasons, but I found that not maybe as flexible as the trimeter in the Greek seemed, the iambic trimeter seemed to me to be. So I wanted to have something that would have that kind of flexibility and allow me to have lines of different lengths. And also, I think unless you're as brilliant and flexible within the formal context of the line as someone like Shakespeare is, you can't really get away with da-dum, 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 like for people listening to that for 3 hours. So I decided on that kind of flexible iambic thing for this, and then for the interaction, and then for the choral passages, I thought I wanted some way of heightening it. As Adele said, we were working with a composer whom Adele had got on board called Mira Kallix, who's great. But at the stage of my writing the text, we didn't know what exactly she would be doing, what she would be scoring. We knew we wanted to have some singing, but we didn't know what we wanted to be sung exactly. And so I wanted to find a kind of flexible lyrical style for the lyric passages that could be set to music if necessary, but if not, was still getting to the heart of the drama and still telling the story as clearly as possible so that the audience could follow it, whether it was sung or it was not sung. And then I guess before I sat down, the final thing was I read a load of stuff in English for ages that I thought was sort of a bit like how I Aeschylus seemed to me to be in English. So the people that I was really, people that I sort of really went for was James Joyce, Gerald Manley Hopkins, Percy Shelley, Allen Ginsberg, Ted Hughes again, in fact. I sort of glut myself on them and just absorb them as much as I could, and the way that their language operated, the muscularity of their language. Also in late Shakespeare, so say Coriolanus, Winter's Tale, I thought that had some of the kind of the way that thought moves so sort of fervidly, so complicatedly, with lots of strange, say Leontes in Winter's Tale, so the thought darts around and uses all these big strange words, but is always kind of completely on point in its in terms of how the character's thought process is moving. So I sort of just absorbed as much of that as possible, and then essentially sat down and in sort of two bursts of 10 days did the translation. And that was, and so, I mean, I generally, when I have written stuff in the past, always try to hit it running. I think I was sort of originally at university, did a lot of acting and stuff. I think the way that I come to drama comes through my sort of minimal, but nevertheless sort of substantial for me, experience as an actor. And so I always want the words to feel on thought, to feel like they have come in the moment. And so I didn't want to sort of go, you know, agonize over, do a sort of Virgil and do a line a day. I wanted to do it as quickly and as sort of feverishly as possible, and that was the end of the kind of technical process of the writing, I guess. I shall now read a bit. I think the best thing for me to do is to read. I'll do it quite quickly, so but I will do quite a substantial bit. I'm going to do the whole of the Parados, which is quite short in my version, thankfully. But that's to give you, I mean, I suppose it's very famous, so if you didn't see the production or don't know what's going on, it's right at the beginning of the play, so and it's the first choral ode. So it will, you know, you'll get a good way into the kind of things that I was doing with the chorus. And then I'll look at a bit later from the Libation Bearers, a little bit of interaction between Orestes and Electra, which is lighter and also probably it gives a good contrast, so you can see the kind of thing that I was doing in the character interaction. But yeah, I'll go and do that now. Or I'll do that now in front of you. Right. 10 years gone, 10 years long since the twin-throned and twin-sceptred sons of Atreus, Menelaus and Agamemnon, set sail for Troy, helming a 1,000-keeled fleet. Like fleet-winged eagles rowing through the sky, like grief-crazed furies, blood-mad, God-sent, so they went. Trojan Paris had ripped Helen from Greek Menelaus' bed, spitting in the face of hospitality and of its patron deity, the god-king Zeus, and so the Greeks would have his head. And many a head would fall, many a member truncated, many a trunk dismembered, and many a drop of young men's blood was swallowed by the dust of Troy before anyone remembered that all this death was just about a woman who fell in love with a boy. We didn't go. We are the ones who didn't fight. With our king Agamemnon gone, we wandered through our days and through our nights, ghosts of ourselves. A fearful decade here at Argos, holding our tongues and our breath. We often thought the fates to be unkind for not sending us abroad, for not sending us to death. We are the ones they left behind. But why do the altar fires rise up tonight? Why do the libations fall? Why all the offerings on display, more palace riches than we've ever seen? Tell us, O Queen, has something happened? Our hearts somersault with delight and dismay. Has something happened? We remember this feeling. It was the same 10 years ago, the same feeling when first the twin kings cast off for the war, and when we stood there on the shore, our hearts were throttled by a sudden fear, and now, right here, tonight, it has returned. Hopeless and hopeless and hopeless say, but hopeful stay, and now we feel the same again. There was an omen then. We saw two eagles, one black, one white, but perfectly a pair, take giddy flight, carrying between their beaks a pregnant hare. And when they reached the apex of the air, they parted, tearing the high up hare apart. Its body, blood, and all its unborn young hung for a moment, still, and then dissolved in the bright sunlight. Hopeless and hopeless and hopeless say, but hopeful stay. The army stopped departing and stared at the sight, and Calchas, prophet of the army, resolved to speak. This is a sign that Zeus condones this mission. This is a sign that lofty Troy shall fall. But it shows too that raw, unchecked ambition shall be the bitter ruin of us all. Hopeless and hopeless and hopeless say, but hopeful stay. For Artemis, huntress goddess, will send a black-winged dog to rip and rend this house apart, in payment for the hare she loved with all her heart. The dog will bring slaughter to this kingdom once beguiled, in vengeance for this kingdom's child. Hopeless and hopeless and hopeless say, but hopeful stay. So he spoke. Zeus, if you're listening, if you were ever really there, Zeus, if you're listening, if that's even your name, God, hear our prayer. Zeus, who vanquished his father, whose father vanquished too, Zeus, listen to us, O Father, grant us wisdom, see us through. Zeus, who made it natural law that she who learns must suffer into truth, see us through. At night, our cares, the pale ghosts of hurt, drip down and down like heavy drops of blood onto our sleepless hearts. Drip down and down until the daylight in its steady flood floods in long-awaited, floods in sudden, fast, and we can hope again. This is how knowledge, this is how God-gotten wisdom comes at last. It comes through pain. Zeus, if you're listening, see us through. Let us see the morning too. And then, 10 years ago, when the war-bound fleet reached Aulis, the winds rose up and up and would not drop, and so the Greek fleet had to stop. Warps groaned, sail sheets grunted, anchor chains strained. Six sailors leaned over sides and drained their six stomachs into the blood-black sea. And mid wind shout, mid blow and gust, Calchas howled that all of this was Artemis, and she must be appeased. Then Agamemnon stood and spoke. I can fix this. It's up to me. I must put on the yoke strap of necessity. The ripped-up hare was pregnant, its young died in the slaughter, so we must pay back blood for blood, young for young, child for child. Someone send to Argos, fetch my eldest daughter, fetch Iphigenia. Prepare the altar, select the knife, give it to me. I'll do it myself, I must be the one to take her life. Her maiden blood must stain her father's hands. You think I want to do it? Look at me, I'm crying. My tears have blurred my vision, I cannot see. Give me the knife. Zeus says we must go to war, so this is the way it must be. I grieve to do it. But I'll do it. Give me the knife. His heart had hardened then. He seemed almost at ease. It's strange. When men are seized by an idea, they will not stop. No matter how impious, how unholy, how impure, they will not stop. No matter what the cost, this war over a woman must be won, and so his daughter must be lost. She tried to run when she saw the altar. Instantly, she knew. She screamed, but they ignored her. They tied her down. Her father said a prayer. She wriggled like a baby goat, and cries for mercy bleated from her frightened throat. So they gagged her, so she couldn't call by name, call out to all the men who'd gathered round, the very same who'd clapped and smiled after she sang at her father's supper parties as a child. The same men now who had nothing to say as they saw her naked skin, as they saw her bright flesh shine white in the places where her saffron-coloured robes fell away. The knife went in. She felt its hilt. She felt her father's hand, her eyes went wide, the dead blood soaked hot into the sand, and it was over. We do not know what happened next. After all, we were not there, we only heard about it. But why go over and over the woes of the past? Only speak good things tonight. Zeus will bring justice and truth again. Zeus will bring knowledge and light, somehow. So why go over and over the woes of the past? That was then, this is now. Mm-hmm. So that's the last bit. And then the next bit is from Libation Bearers, where Orestes, Electris meets Orestes for the first time. I'm going to play both parts, but I'll maybe do a slightly different voice. Not like weird accent or anything, but maybe just change the tone so that you know that they're the two characters. But hopefully it'll be obvious. So this is Electra's finished talking, and then Orestes and Pylades emerge. Your prayers have been answered. May they continue to be so. What prayers? What have the gods granted me, stranger? You now stand face to face with someone you've long prayed for. Who's that then? Who have I prayed for so long? You've prayed for Orestes. You've prayed for your banished brother. So how have my prayers been answered, stranger? Tell me. It's me. I am the one you love the most. I am your brother. Is this a trick? Is this a net to trap me, stranger? If it is, I've also trapped myself. Do you laugh at me? Do you mock my sufferings? I feel your sufferings. They are my own. Orestes, my brother, is it really you? So when you saw that my hairlock on the tomb, you dared believe, but now I stand in front of you, you are suspicious. I understand your trepidation, but look, here is the place from where I snipped the lock, and this stitching, look, here, you see, was done by your deft fingers. Do you remember? I know it's hard to give your heart to hope, but give it to the truth, my sister. I'm home. It's me.
Oh, thank you very much. That's great. I really actually want to throw things open, but if I can just ask one question first, because it seems to me that the two of you came together. Adele primarily, well, not primarily, but at any rate, a lot of it driven by ideas of design, visuality, by and film.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rory comes to it from poetry in many ways, you know, from reading Hopkins and reading Hughes and so on, and Leontes, but with a theatrical cast of mind rather than a paper cast of mind. What I'd like to know is, when you then got together in rehearsal, to what extent did you adapt to what Rory gave you? And Rory, did you to in any ways change things in the light of the way that the rehearsals developed?
Well, actually, that's interesting because the first thing Rory said was how little time he had to actually write the translation. And actually, his deadline for the draft was after our design deadline. So we had to give in our design ideas to the production team kind of so many months in advance so they could start building things. So we had to have quite a lot of involved conversations in the run-up to Rory going away to write it. So a lot of it weirdly stayed the same. If I had the time, theoretically, it would be interesting to do it again and to know whether or not, just going from Rory's draft, I would have made changes, which is probable. But we just wouldn't have had any set or costumes if we'd waited. I mean, they could have done it in the pants and vest, like when you're in school and you had turned up without your gym kit. But in the 80s. But for those of you born after the 80s, oh, it was a weird time. It's a really weird project, unique project for me, because we had to kind of get on and make it before it was written.
Yeah. And the only way around that would have been for somehow to have the budget for longer.
Rehearse it for longer, which would have been ideal, because I think you could probably rehearse the show forever and not get fed up of it.
Yes.
I mean, and to not even feel like you've scratched the surface of it.
It's been brought home to us in various ways recently, how in France and even in Germany, they're much longer rehearsal time.
Absolutely.
And the British theatre is so driven by short rehearsals.
Yeah, times. Economics, I guess, at the heart of it. But it was a pretty short rehearsal period for a show this massive. I mean, it is amazing that, you know, as you all know, I'm sure, you could do 100 versions of it and still kind of have more to go, I think. It just endlessly kind of keeps shifting and moulding. And whenever you think, oh, this is the way through it, you go, but maybe Orestes, really hates his mum, or maybe he's sexually obsessed with his mother, or maybe she doesn't love Agamemnon, maybe she does. I mean, you could kind of do every single one of them. I don't think you'd be wrong. It's an amazingly open text in that respect.
I don't like changing things.
No. And I didn't need to change it.
I think there is a sort of a kind of tradition of a dramaturgical process with a script, in the in the British theatre, which, yeah, I think, again, is guided by the production in the last, say, 50 years or so of realistic slash naturalistic plays, which involves the writer changing things because the words don't seem to be doing the job that they feel like the emotions need to be getting to, or that the director and the actors discover in rehearsals that a kind of a necessary corner that has to be turned isn't quite being turned in the right way or whatever. And I don't write plays like that. I don't want to. I think this is essentially a poetic play, and I think theatre is more naturally lends itself to being a poetic medium. And so we did make changes in that we cut things because it was necessary for timing, but also for the staging of very specific elements to take certain things out or to kind of compress certain things. But I think generally when changes are made in the sense of because the actor can't find the... I think in what Aeschylus has done, and hopefully in what I've given, if I've done, to use a very apt word, it any justice, would give the actors a wealth of options for each moment for how to do each thing. And so it's more about finding it's sort of, if it's not working, then a different tack needs to be taken with how they're thinking about the character, rather than how the poetic line is working.
But what about, say, which words to emphasise in a particular sentence? You know, or the pacing of a sentence? Does that come primarily from you, or primarily from Adele, or somehow from both of you?
I'm sure probably from both, because I think that Rory's text is very specifically honed rhythmically. So I think if you've got 12 people to say it, there would be things that would come out, you know, naturally. Often, the first read-through of something is usually fantastic, and then you have to try and get the actors to kind of strip away all the bullshit that they bring and go back to that. because it's a strange play in that respect. And even probably, you know, even more so than Sophocles or Euripides, because they do kind of start to, I guess... From a modern theatre director's perspective, they do feel like they're shifting towards something like character and psychology. Whereas the thing that really interests me about this is that always these characters are mythical figures. Always they're bigger than being single human beings, which is why it's possible for Clytemnestra to be the woman she is in Agamemnon, and then something very different in Libation Bearers. And then to be this completely different thing again as a ghost in the Eumenides. But that's kind of the point of it. So I was always trying to encourage the actors to kind of move away from a Stanislavskian approach to character, I guess. Because I think you probably end up in a cycle forever of trying to make certain decisions. And like I said, you know, the text is so open and so reflexive that you want your audience to go away thinking, well, all of these things are possible within this character. It's an impossible task, but you do limit yourself if you then decide, well, my character's done this because of this, and so therefore this will impact this, this, and this. You know, you start to kind of streamline things in a way that's probably not useful. And especially because one of the things I haven't mentioned is about the Globe is that its audience is, probably the majority of its audience will be a non-traditional theatre-going audience. So often they come from, they don't know it, or they're quarter of the audience are from international, tourists, school kids, whatever. You know, you want to make a production that kind of speaks to all of those people rather than to do something clever on the theme of Clytemnestra in this production, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that worked. I think you succeeded. I think that really worked.
Well,
yeah.
Gosh, if you did like 1% succeeded in that ridiculous ambition, then yeah, that'd be good.
Now, I don't want to hog the discussion, so please, who would like to chip in? Yes, please. Yeah.
So thank you very much. I'm a huge fan of the translation and of the production, but I'm a little bit perplexed by something that you Adele said now, that you were restricted to portraying the Furies in the third play as you did.
Yes.
Because of practical reasons, but I remember. So I thought that making the chorus speak in masculine voices,
yes,
those of them who had was brilliant. And then I remember reading an interview, I think it was Rory, who said that that the chorus were encouraged to use their masculine. So now I'm a little bit late because well, he said it was a practical reason, but I think that not only did it work very well, but also it did enormous justice to, you know, that complex gender identity.
Great.
And the Furies. So maybe you would want to change the narrative in the next.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, I'll say it's totally deliberate. Well, yeah, I think probably I'm being a bit glib, and I think, you know, we would have wanted to have used Dennis and Brendan in the chorus anyway, because they, for all sorts of reasons, they were kind of wonderful people to do that. But I guess, you know, as a director, you kind of, you know these things, and they're in the ether, but then there's also kind of, you know, accidents play a huge, there's no director on earth that doesn't know, like, a great deal to just accidents and circumstance and limitations being thrust on you, and then those limitations working out rather beautifully. So I guess it's probably where that begins, where the deliberation begins, and where we were thrust upon it probably is a much more blurry grey area than I'm kind of making it out to be. Yeah.
Parameters can be freeing.
Yeah, totally.
Like, if you've got, I don't know, I think if they said to us, you know, you've got, we'll do the Oresteia whenever, with as many people as you want in it, in any space in the world that you want, then we just probably both
I
die.
Think we both implode.
Like, there's no, whereas having those specifics of the
it's
things
true.
That made this what it was.
Pushing against limitations is always really exciting. Limiting your palette's always like the best thing to do as an artist. So sorry, yeah, totally deliberate. In fact, I think really early on we talked about, like, I think back in the day where we were dreaming about it, I think we talked about the whole chorus being women all the way through would have been fantastic. I mean, mainly, you know, to kind of have some sort of gender balance in that theatre, because, of course, the main thrust of their work being Shakespeare means that, you know, something like 80% of the cast are male, which is always incredibly frustrating. So maybe in another world I would love to do an entirely female Oresteia.
That'd be great.
There was one in Finland.
Oh, really?
Yes, an entirely female Oresteia.
What
a
great idea. Yeah. We'd do it again, Rory.
Do Finland.
Yes, please.
It seems to me that modernist and postmodernist writers really turned back to the ancient Greeks, and that this was a conscious choice, which also paradoxically generates a kind of modern aesthetic through their use of ancient material. So how instrumental do you think that the compression of the ancient text is to generating a modern dramatic aesthetic?
The compression.
Yes. Well, I guess it allowed the, I think attention spans are always governed by the way that culture is absorbed generally in the ether. So I do feel like on some levels, our collective attention spans have been reduced by being able to do things like YouTube and to sort of flick on and off from the brilliant films or programs in front of us on a screen whenever we want to do that. But I think that on the other hand, it doesn't. I mean, I think I'd have loved to have done the whole thing. I don't. The compression for me was very much a practical choice. Mm. Rather than because we knew that we couldn't actually, because of the things like they need to change the set around, what time would we have finished it in order to get to the last tube, and because they have two shows a day and stuff, we couldn't have done a 6-hour one. Mm. But I would have, you know, I'd have loved to have had a go at doing the whole text. I do think there's something kind of slightly sacred about the theatre that exists outside potentially of these ideas about how we're taking in culture, because it's so different, because you turn your phone off, because you all kind of buy into a shared contract to be silent and to be in the place, be in a place with this story. I think, you know, of course it can test your attention span. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of things like opera. I often go to the opera and I'm really bored, but nevertheless, really like it. Even though I was quite bored, there were kind of moments of lucidity that have made it completely worth it. And just to be in that meditative space with it, I think it's sort of, it's kind of feels sacred and democratic. And so, again, it was practical rather than, I think, maybe in the necessary way that kind of postmodern writing was pushing me.
There is something, I mean, sorry to bang on about this, but because the Globe is... it's really different in how theatre going to the Globe is so different to people going to the theatre anywhere else. And I guess, you know, people aren't going there out of a sense of civic duty in the way that the ancient Greeks would have been doing, of course, as well as, you know, to be entertained. It is a night out for people, but also, you know, there's a kind of weight. I felt very conscious that we are the holders of a very delicate thing, which is thousands and thousands of young people's first time at the theatre. The last thing you want to do is for them to walk out and to vow never, ever to go to the theatre again as long as they live. And I feel very conscious of that anyway as a theatre director, because I want people to come out the other side and go, ah, I want to do that again, I want it, like a roller coaster. Because I think theatre is extraordinary. I think, you know, it's intellectually it is a roller coaster, and spiritually it's a roller coaster. And like Rory said, that thing of being together is... it's so rare in the community that we live in now. We don't come together in commune in quite the same way. I did a show a few years ago now called The Passion in Port Talbot, which was a massive community passion play. And doing that changed how I thought about theatre forever, because suddenly I thought, well, this is a ritual that we all go through together. But to do that, you've got to enjoy every second of it. And the minute that you lose a 15-year-old boy, then that's him lost to the theatre forever. So I guess that kind of plays a massive part. But maybe if we'd done it again indoors or some, then yes, to push it and to make it a 6-hour-long epic would have been fantastic. But when you've got people standing up, then you're quickly going to regret making them stand up for 6 hours, mainly because they won't. No one will wash the amenities, they'll have gone home.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering how far you read humour in Aeschylus, or whether that's something you felt that modern adaptation needs to do to make sense of elements in the play that might be bizarre or uncomfortable for modern audiences.
So I think the thing with the Globe space is that, and also the performers that the Globe therefore hires to play in that space, is they have the space puts you in an incredible position of intimacy with the audience, because of that thing that I was talking about when I had to do it, and you know, you have to have a connection with someone right there. You can't kind of ignore the connection and play the fourth wall. You have to be in the space, which means that necessarily its tendency is to hire actors who have the ability to be right there, which means a lot of the time people who are very funny. And therefore, because a laugh in there feels so kind of cathartic, and also because it's so good, I think a lot of the time people, that the performers want to get the laugh. Maybe sometimes in something like this it's better to steer them away from it. I think my tendency when I started off writing comedy sketches before I wrote anything full length, so I think there probably is a kind of inherent sort of something verbal going on where there's possibility for comedy, even if it's just going to come out. And I think that plus the actors meant that there were going to be moments where that was going to happen. I'm not really sure about it in Aeschylus, because I feel like humour would have worked very differently. I suppose it's a general blanket all thing that I don't really know what the audience would have been like, what they would have got from it, what they would have thought was good or bad, what would have been provocative to them, what would have felt like a longer, or what would have felt like it was. So my only gauge is sort of what I got from it, reading it, what is the thing that hit me, and then this is, you know, this the bit that I read out, like I feel like it is base, which often got a big laugh, although I don't think it's actually that funny a line, but thinking about it is kind of structured like a joke when Orestes says, and I mean it is almost a literal translation, I think, I can't remember, but where he says, so when you saw my hair you didn't believe, but now I'm actually here you do, that feels like it is the way that that's structured, a kind of absurdity is something that would produce that is potentially going to be funny. But as I said, I have no idea whether your civic role at the time was to sit there stony faced nodding, or whether it was kind of bawdy and enjoyable, much like that building the Globe seems to have been.
And I think you have to resign yourself. Like it's always surprising to me when I make a show there, or in the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse, which is the smaller Jacobean indoor place I've made two shows in, but there's particularly there laughter, you do have to kind of slightly give up your kind of ego, and I kind of, you know, we certainly kind of work towards it being quite a serious piece of theatre, but it, from the beginning the audience will find things to laugh at, and that's not always a sign that they're finding something funny. It's often that they feel uncomfortable or nervous, or that they're being drawn to something that is darker or stranger, or they just want to release something. What do? You scream? No, you don't. You know, you're taught not to scream on the top of your voice. But people, so people laugh for all sorts of reasons. And I kind of, initially I was a bit nervous about it, but actually I think it's something quite lovely about that. Laughter is an amazing kind of hole into your audience, you know, quite literally. It's an amazing moment of complicity. And I kind of miss that when I work in theatres that aren't outdoors and don't elicit that kind of communal response. Yeah. I guess, you know, if you go to a church service, you have words you say back to people when you feel something. Maybe they did that, I don't know, but nowadays laughter, especially there, because that's what people are used to doing when they go to the Globe.
But did you get laughs which you didn't want, which you tried to work against,
yeah,
or did you
absolutely.
Go with them?
I think, it's difficult. I mean, it's kind of not even up to you at a certain point. You can, you know, you can try really hard to push against certain things. That doesn't always kind of do you any favours in there. And to be honest, whenever you kind of quash one joke, then it will pop up somewhere else. You just can't decide where that audience are going to. But yeah, I guess, you know, we kind of tried to make sure that people felt something for the characters and that they were following the story and that they weren't being pushed away from it. You know, that they weren't laughing because they were kind of stepping back from it.
I do think that kind of any good work of art's probably going to have a fairly broad spectrum of human feeling in it.
Mm.
And so if you're not kind of laughing at once in a show, I'm usually
really
fairly suspicious. In fact, it's something that I've always felt like a lot of the productions of Greek, not all of them, but a lot of the productions of Greek tragedy I've seen in my relatively limited London theatre going over the last sort of 5 years or whatever, they're often so humourless and so determined to be kind of, I don't know, like granite and this is serious, maybe there's kind of unintentional laughter out of the ridiculousness, or it's just sort of just feels kind of so up itself and humorless that I don't really want to be in thought, like I don't really want to be there in the space with that kind of idea of what human beings are.
But there are very different kinds of laughter, aren't there?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There are some that you want to work with and some that work against you.
Yeah.
I think we tried to manage the laughter, particularly with the Furies, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
David,
did you have men as the narration bearers or something?
Yes, we did. Yeah, partly the same reason that I was talking to Emanuela about just now, that I adopted a cast from another play, so they were the cast for Measure for Measure. So that meant that while I would have loved to have had all women in the libation bearers, we had to had to have some men in the chorus as well, unfortunately. So that was another accident, but it worked okay, I thought, in the end. Yeah, sorry, so very boring explanation, I'm sorry.
Went into the text though, because we knew
yes,
that, so
that's
I
right.
sort of didn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I took out, and again in the Agamemnon, I took out the bit where they said we're all sort of old, and made it just the people who generically didn't fight, because they weren't old for the most part.
Yes.
So.
Yes, please.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Rory wrote the Athenian song, didn't you? Because then I enforced the cock on the ending. But I guess sometimes it would really differ. Sometimes people would find it really unsettling, and sometimes people would kind of find it quite triumphant. I mean, I kind of wanted it in an ideal world to be quite unsettling, because I find the dominance of the patriarchy at the end of the play really terrifying and obviously wrong and bad as a woman. But nevertheless, that's how the play ends. So I kind of wanted people to go away and to go, what does this mean? Which I guess actually I was listening to something Bertie Carvel, the fantastic Bertie Carvel, was talking about the Bat Guy, and he said that, you know, these plays are there. And I guess what Rory's saying as well, that, you know, modern adaptations have tried to kind of streamline what those plays mean, so that when you walk away, you go away thinking, this is what this play is about. It's the Bat Guy, so it's about madness, or it's about power, or it's about... But actually, he said, you know, these plays are designed to kind of elicit more questions than they are kind of solid, secure answers. So I wanted to bring it because... I wanted to put it there because... Because I like the idea of conflating the kind of end of an ancient Greek play and the Dionysian walk to the river. And I really wanted to take everyone down to the Thames. But unfortunately, we did have 1,500 people. It would be really difficult to kind of move them down to the Thames together. I think maybe the Thames would have more problem than we would in the theatre. It would be really kind of terrifying. But so I just wanted it to be a kind of provocative statement, I guess, and one that deliberately kind of made everything feel quite triumphant when, in fact... its triumph is really undermined by horrible, particular political kind of line, if that makes sense.
So insofar as that was a kind of jaunty ending, you actually meant that to be, to have a dark underside.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, coming out, I mean, if you watch it as a modern audience, certainly for my perspective, watching it on stage or reading it, you know, but the point at which Athena says, well, I'm from, you know, I side with the man because I am my father's child, is the point at which I start going, hang on, what? Wait, what? And so that you're kind of dragged along, that this carnival erupts out of that final statement. But I mean, personally, I would love, my favourite reaction would be for everyone to go, what? I'm sorry, what did you say? I'm sorry, what? 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 And just because of the screaming to get louder and louder and louder. But it's always fun to kind of, you know, to drag people in a different direction, to let them think 2 days later, or to let them a year later or a month later, to start to go, what does that mean? Often modern theatre, I mean, I don't know if Rory disagrees or agrees with me, but often, you know, as a director, you're drilled and told, and critics certainly want you to kind of make one statement. And there's nothing worse, really, I think.
Yeah, that's why a lot of modern theatre is quite bad, and these plays are still around.
Yeah,
it's because they are asking all of these... Are they asking all these questions? I mean, so, as me personally, someone from the outside, so I had nothing to do with penis. reading it, especially kind of watching it on the last night, I was suddenly so aware. I think almost every, certainly of my translation, and I guess this is something that I've somehow, unless it's my own preoccupation, it's something that I've somehow osmosed from the Greek. Almost every single line has something about man or woman and what that means. And so for that to be this thing that's in constant flux and constant sort of, there's a constant argument about this all the way through. I was totally astonished by that a lot of the, that the kind of, especially the mainstream critical reaction seemed completely not to pick up on the, which I thought was a very feminist production, and I thought that it was, for me at least, as an outsider, as someone watching it with a more critical eye rather than somebody watching it watching it as a person in the production team, it seemed to me to be a sort of a very feminist statement that at the end of that, kind of no one really got what they were just sort of like, oh yeah, it's this play that's really good, and then at the end there's this penis. Why did that happen? So I was really surprised.
It's because British critics can't read visual imagery. Basically, if what you have to do with a British theatre critic is you have to at one point stand up and have your character say a line that goes, this is the theme, and then they can carry on with whatever they're doing, and however good or bad the show is, the British critic will then go, I got it. But if you put a visual image on stage, it's like it all goes to static. They suddenly can't see it. It's absolutely astonishing.
But I suppose if the phallus is domineering, bullying, patriarchal, and so on, that it was gold and had wings.
Quite calm.
Is exactly, you know, there's a kind of...
We wanted to slightly undercut it.
Because it seems to be such a nice sort of ethereal phallus.
Going to
go fluttering off.
Yeah, you know? Like we all are. But that's what the play does, doesn't it? It doesn't go, you know, so Orestes, you're released and every woman's now going to be brought up and slaughtered.
No.
It kind of goes, yay, at the end, and they sort of celebrate, here we are in modern Athens. So we kind of didn't want to, we didn't want to make the statement that heavily, but again, if I had, then, you know, maybe the mainstream theatre critics would have gone, got it. There is something, you know, sorry, so there's something kind of unsettling about how camp it is, I guess. I wanted to kind of put, you know, put at the end of it. Anyway,
yes,
another question.
Yeah.
So there was another bit of visual imagery at the end that I found even more unsettling, actually, which might just be my preoccupation. So the satyr was blacked up.
Well, he was painted black.
So I found that really. I thought it was a matter of casting that Cassandra was black, and that gave another resonance of transatlantic slavery. But to see someone in blackface and to see a satyr with all the connotations and all the terrible racist connotations.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, so I was almost ignoring a great big gold palace.
That's interesting.
But I don't know whether it was just chance that. It sounds like it might not have been intended to be blacked up.
No, well, he was intended to be painted black, which I think is different to being blacked up. Because, if that makes sense, he's not. We're never trying to make him a black man. He is just purely painted black, which I know they are two different, very subtly different things, I think. And that's partly because all of the imagery that we found and really loved of satyrs were kind of really kind of black, kind of all these beautiful black pictures, and especially vases and the ancient Greek kind of... what are they called, you know, the side of the vase. So, yes, I mean, we'd never considered it racially.
It is completely my preoccupation as well, so I wasn't sure if that...
Yeah, yeah, well, no, it's really, I mean, it's really fascinating. Of course, we'd never, you know, a million years have wanted to kind of create any offence in any way, shape or form, or to make it a kind of racial issue. But it purely came from we loved kind of referencing the side of those vases, just right at the end. So that's all I can say about that, really, I think.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. It was one of those ones where I wasn't sure if I was the only person in the audience doing that. Or
I wonder. Maybe not.
That would have... Every critic would have mentioned it.
Would have mentioned it. How interesting.
And somehow the way the dynamics work here is different, and you're producing a hit, so that's...
Intriguing. If you thought it, then you're probably not the only person.
So, Peter...
Could I ask Rory a question which relates to visual impact, which is stage directions, because I didn't see the show, but I read your text with much enjoyment, and I was struck in the Agamemnon, your stage direction is pretty minimal. We have a herald appears, Agamemnon and Cassandra appear, Clytemnestra is there. And every time Clytemnestra is there, and I thought, reading that, I thought that's brilliant, because that brings out the uncanny way in which she's dominating the doorway. I then went on to the next two plays, and we got more and more is-theres, so that by the end, practically everything was is-there. And so I wondered, was I wrong to see significance?
I think is-there is generally the stage direction for I use instead of enters, and I used it for a specific... So the with the herald appearing, that's because the chorus talk about the herald. Mm. So I think that was why you used that specific verb. But the original reason was because there's this sort of, there's the bit in the Parados where they're talking about, that they address the queen, and obviously they're not being stage directions in the original. You don't know if she is there or not. And so I liked the idea of is there, first of all, because it's so present and simple, and did express, particularly for Clytemnestra, the idea that these characters just are suddenly there in the space. But also there's a kind of grammatical ambiguity with is there, because you can have had them arrive sooner if you want to as a director. And ultimately, I feel like my job for this was to provide Adele with as many choices as possible. And so I felt like when she could have been there beforehand, if I said Cassandra enters, that's saying no, I as the writer have decided Cassandra must walk into the space now, whereas to say is there means she could have arrived before. This is just the moment that the audience acknowledges that her presence is felt. So
Or we could reveal her, or
I guess.
So did that event lead to discussion between you about what was meant by
No, but I mean, absolutely, you know, so I talked a lot with Katie in rehearsal about that idea, and a lot of what we spend our time doing was trying to work out what, you know, how you make someone be there. But it certainly makes sense for Clytemnestra, who's got the kind of hawk-like sixth sense about, well, I don't know, sensing a dramatic moment.
I like the way that in the text they just speak and then they're there. So I wanted to put minimal buffers between that feeling, but also the feeling of that this in some way is making an acknowledgement towards the production we're doing and a kind of contemporary dramaturgy or stagecraft. I mean, my initial idea for the play, which I still think would be cool, was just to do it as the Greek text exists and have no character names and no stage directions and just basically say Adele can decide when people turn up and who's saying this line. When I pitched that idea to Dominic Drumgoole, he wasn't very happy. I think it was a bit too avant-garde, despite the fact that it's kind of the opposite of avant-garde.
Yeah, it's really ancient.
So, yeah, anyway.
I think maybe it's tea time. Not very Dionysian, but quite but quite communal. I think this has really helped me see why I like this production so much. And I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, the things that worked in the theatre, at least for me, I've found it very, very interesting, very reassuring to find that they're thought through, but they're not accidental, that these guys knew what they were doing and set about doing it. I hope you've all found it as fascinating as I have, and I'd like to thank them very warmly, and then please do feel free to come and chat with them over a cuppa. So thank you very much, Rory and Adele.